You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Suzanne Maloney, and I'm Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all today for an event as part of the project, The Brookings Blueprints for American Renewal and Prosperity. By way of background, the Brookings Blueprints aim to provide a new Congress and a new administration with innovative, actionable policy ideas. Historic challenges face our society, and Brookings is committed to advancing big ideas to respond to the crises and opportunities of this moment. The Blueprint series was launched in December 2020, and we've previously held events on economic growth and dynamism, as well as on racial justice and worker mobility. For this third event in the Blueprint series, we'll be focusing on challenges to international security and solutions for moving forward. These challenges include managing the difficulties posed by China's rise, retooling U.S. alliances in Europe and Asia, right-sizing America's role in the Middle East, and addressing a range of transnational threats, including the risk of future pandemics and perennial concerns about proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. To help advance our thinking on these issues, I'm delighted to welcome a panel of Brookings authors to this webinar. Senior Fellow David Dollar will discuss China. Senior Fellow and Director of our Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors, Vonda Felbab-Brown, will be talking about how to prevent the next pandemic. Visiting Fellow Jim Goldgeier will examine America's alliances around the world. And Senior Fellow Bruce Jones will be speaking to the international order. The conversation will be moderated by our Director of Research, Mike O'Hanlon, who also authored a piece for the project on biological, nuclear, climate, and digital risks. A final reminder that we're on the record and streaming live, so please send us your questions to events@brookings.edu or via Twitter using the hashtag BrookingsBlueprints. Thanks so much for joining today. I'll now pass the mic over to Mike O'Hanlon to moderate today's discussion.
Thank you, Suzanne, and greetings, everyone. Again, we're delighted that you're with us today, and we want to thank John Allen, our president, for providing the vision to organize this concept of a blueprint series, as well as our colleague Amy Liu and her fellow Metropolitan Studies experts for really shepherding the whole thing. And now we are focused, indeed, as Suzanne has just said, on the foreign policy piece. And I'm just going to make a couple of additional framing thoughts, and then we'll start with Vonda, who has studied conservation and human encroachment on wildlife sanctuaries and forests and open air markets and places where pandemic disease can originate or be transmitted. So she's going to begin by talking about COVID-19 and pandemic disease more generally and really preventing the next one as much as dealing with the current crisis. And we'll then go to David Dollar, who is an expert on a country that's going to have no small part in any future challenge, certainly including pandemic disease, and that's China, where the Biden administration has no greater challenge in terms of developing an overall strategy, since we've seen the 40-year period of general consensus on U.S.-China relations really dissolve over the last decade, and it's been a bipartisan process. Donald Trump may have had his own particular style and his own disruptive approach for changing the way we handle China, but he was not alone in thinking that much had to be different in the future and that the relationship has reached a more stressful point, and yet certainly, we would all agree that avoiding war and preventing a descent into all-out rivalry is important. David will speak to those questions. We'll then go to Jim Goldgeier, who, as Suzanne noted, has written a paper with Lindsay Ford on America's alliances. And this is an intriguing and very rich paper because it's not a simple recommendation for just expanding one alliance or pulling back another, but more about rethinking and reorienting many of our existing alliances and less official, less formal security structures as we try to deal, among other things, with China's rise and the threat to democracy around the world, the threat from weapons of mass destruction in the hands of North Korea and perhaps Iran and other challenges where there is certainly going to be a somewhat rivalrous and competitive relationship with both China and Russia, even as we seek to cooperate with those countries in other ways. And finally, Bruce Jones will address this from the perspective of democracies, the same set of questions And many of you who have been following the news and thinking about this question understand that many have proposed some kind of a community of democracies or a summit of democracies, a coalition of democracies, a way of uniting America's allies in Europe with those in East Asia, with countries like India and Indonesia that are not formal security partners, yet are crucial to how we handle many problems on the world stage, Russia and China to be sure, but also the new security threats of pandemic disease, climate change, and whatnot. So that's the agenda we have for you today. And we will begin by really just allowing each author to answer a broad framing question from me, tell us a little about their problem, their paper, their ideas and recommendations. And then we will have another round of discussion here before getting to your questions. I should say one additional thematic question is, to what extent do we need new structures of either domestic or international governance, new institutions, new mechanisms, change of the UN Security Council, some kind of beefed up WHO, World Health Organization, you name it. In other words, to what extent is this moment in history sort of like the late 1940s when a lot of new structures were built up after World War II? Or by contrast, to what extent do we already have the machinery and the organizations in place, but it's a question of using them in a better way and using them more effectively with some new policies and maybe some additional resources? Doesn't have to be an either or answer to the question, but that's still an interesting tension and thematic point that we'll pursue as we move forward. So without further ado, thank you again, everyone, for joining us. And Vonda, the floor is now yours. And please tell us again what you would recommend by way of preventing the next pandemic. I think that's a big enough question on everyone's mind that I don't have to add a whole lot more to motivate the discussion. Over to you, my friend.
Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you, Suzanne, for stellar leadership of the Foreign Policy Program and our participation in the Brookings Blueprint Project under President John Allen. Before I speak about the need to focus on deep prevention through conservation of preventing the occurrence of zoonosis, namely the jump of viral spillover from animals to humans, let me remind us of some of the sobering facts of the current COVID-19 coronavirus epidemic. So far in the year of the disease emergence and its spread, we have had 2.2 million people dying of the disease globally, and over 100 million people infected. In the United States alone, we are close to 450,000 people dying of COVID, with almost 100,000 dying just in January alone. We are looking at several months of devastating numbers that will be in the tens of thousands. Globally, 150 million people have been pushed into extreme poverty, and the number is likely a vast understatement. Essentially, 1 year of COVID, less than 1 year of COVID, has wiped out two decades, 25 years of anti-poverty efforts around the world. And the way people have been pushed into extreme poverty, often demanding that they liquidate all of their productive assets, means that they will not be able to escape the poverty, return to lower middle class for years, decades, and perhaps their entire lives. It might be only that the next generation will be able to make that recovery. Around the world, including in the United States, we are seeing recessions on the order not seen since World War II or even longer. In the US case, the GDP contraction of about 3.6%. Globally, or in various parts of the world, we are looking at contractions, 8%, 9%, 6%, very significant impact. All of this should tell us that preventing, both mitigating immediately the current coronavirus, but preventing the next pandemic needs to be at the top of policy agenda, including national security agenda. The COVID-19 is not one in a 100-year issue, as it's sometimes being talked about. The rate of zoonosis, the rate at which viruses from animals spill to humans, and viruses to which humans do not have acquired immunity systems because they have not been exposed to these novel viruses has been increasing rapidly as we have been destroying natural environments, particularly tropical natural environments. But a whole bank of viruses are also likely to emerge with the melting of permafrost in the Arctic and subarctic regions. There is really nothing surprising about the fact that COVID has arisen. We have been at the we have been seeing the emergence of zoonosis at the rate of about one significant one every 3 years over the past two decades, and we have been merely lucky that prior epidemics have not reached the level of pandemic, or prior occurrences have not reached the level of an epidemic. So what we are reaping today are the effects of our actions of destroying nature at a pace that now is far greater, biodiversity loss far greater than any time since the extinction of dinosaurs. And that is about 1,000 times higher than is the historic average. What do we then do specifically to prevent the next pandemic? Well, we have to fundamentally change how we interact with nature. And we need to particularly focus on the sources of zoonosis and their spread to humans and their escalation into epidemic and pandemic levels. This requires this core essence, minimizing human interface with wild animals and wild spaces. Eliminating or at least reducing significantly the transmission points where the likelihood of viral spillover is very high. Those include particularly unhygienic commercial markets and wild animal meat and live animals. Those also include legal trade, which is massive around the world, including in the United States. Yet tiny percentage of legal trade in wild animals is in fact monitored for any kind of pathogen spread, whether it's import to the United States or export elsewhere in the world. And it also means diligently suppressing illegal trade in wildlife and poaching and conserving natural habitats. Despite the devastation of COVID, we have really started just taking very tepid steps toward this very significant agenda. In fact, much of 2020 has been a year of far greater losses and steps back. We have seen the greatest deforestation rates in Brazil and Indonesia in many years. We have seen a catastrophic collapse of ecotourism to many areas where ecotourism is fundamental for generating income for biodiversity preservation and habitat preservation, particularly Africa, but not solely Africa. We have seen intensified rate of poaching, and we have seen by and large very meager responses from governments. I would like to highlight one response, and that is of China, the place where COVID-19 has likely made the jump from animals to humans, and that it certainly spread to the initial epidemic levels. China has banned its consumption of wild animal meat, a very significant, very important step forward. And it has also shut down its markets with wild animals that have prior to this point been sources of zoonosis such as SARS. It has also shut down some of its many wildlife farms, although others are oriented toward production of traditional Chinese medicine, with the core problems of unhygienic veterinary conditions still persisting. So that swap really is one more on paper than in reality preventing the spread. Nonetheless, some very significant steps taken there. We have essentially not seen similar comparable measures elsewhere, particularly in key areas of high risk, such as Indonesia, for example, where devastatingly dangerous urban markets in wild animals and animal meat remain robust. Those markets also exist in Africa, where they can be sources of subsistence, but are also sources of luxury goods for urban populations. So what does this mean then in terms of policy? Well, as I mentioned, we need to reduce or eliminate sources of transmission. Phasing out hygienic market in wild animals and meat is a first step and needs to be a policy it is supported beyond merely China. Similarly, phasing out dangerous wildlife farms that are stocked from the wild and where domestic livestock and animals interact and are kept in unhygienic conditions also need to be phased out. None of this means that we should stop all trade in wildlife. That would be counterproductive because it is often economic incentives that drive any kind of conservation. Well-managed legal trade in wildlife, such as trophy hunting and its other dimensions, are critical elements of preserving habitats and thus critical elements of preventing viral spillovers. However, requires doing some important work on dealing with subsistence use of wild animal meat that can be source of zoonosis and has been source of zoonosis. The Central American, African rather markets are prime example. There are many more recommendations that I can return to in the question and answer period. I want to highlight one, however. Many of these measures, cracking down far more significantly on poaching and on wildlife trafficking, phasing out these markets, will fail unless we develop much better mechanisms for funding biodiversity. This is really where a lot of policy focus needs to be located and where we are, even in less than initial stages, where significant gaps remain and existing payments for ecosystem services are inadequate, clumsy, not generating what they need to be generating. And finally, we need to elevate, as I mentioned at the beginning, the focus on nature preservation and pandemic prevention to all elements of policies. Massive amount of different behavioral and policy approaches need to take place in the United States. We are guilty of having a legal trade that is completely unmonitored. How to prevent pandemics and conserve biodiversity needs to be synchronized with climate issues. Often they stand in contradictions in existing policy. It needs to be brought into thinking about a whole variety of internal and external management. And that requires some new institution, such as at the international level, where there is no entity so far that's focused on so-called one health, the notion that our health, human health, is intimately linked to the health of animals and biodiversity. The existing mechanisms, whether it's WHO or CITES, do not grapple with the agenda. So new thinking needs to take place there, in addition to the elevation of pandemic proofing, if you would like, biodiversity conservation, being integrating across the vast domains of policy and being brought and the resources being brought to accomplish that. Thanks, Mike.
Vonda, that was fantastic. Let me ask one small clarifying question before moving on to David Dollar, because at the very end, you talked about institutions. And as you know, one of the questions for this project has been, to what extent do we need to change the institutions? You mentioned that WHO and the Committee on International Trade and Endangered Species, if I remember the acronym correctly, CITES, that they often operate today in stovepipe fashion. Are you saying they need to just be brought together and collaborate more, or are you suggesting the creation of a new organization that would somehow supersede either or both and take a more combined approach to the problem?
Well, neither CITES, the Convention on traded endangered species, nor WHO deal with the issue. CITES merely regulates trade in wildlife. And if an animal is listed as threatened or endangered, legal trade becomes suspended or conditional. But it does not focus on pandemic zoonosis, that entire agenda. WHO focuses on health, but does not focus on nature conservation and the linkage between animal and biodiversity health and our own health. So the body really is not there. Certainly, there is a need to avoid stovepiping. But this concept of one health will perhaps require either new institutions or new amalgamations, both internally and externally. And I would just highlight here Germany, which has moved to an interesting innovation of creating a new ministry that will operate as one health ministry, integrating both veterinary and biodiversity issues and public health under one institution. This is just in the initial stages. We don't know how well that will be implemented, what its challenges will be. For me, the first step is not even creating new institutions, but rather having every institution, whether it's Department of Interior, Borders and Customs and Borders, State Department, USAID, Treasury, ASEAN, think about what are the regulatory opportunities and how every domain of trade, of import, of making decisions about deforestation, who is given licenses to cultivate African oil palm that produces deforestation, are made cognizant and minimize the change of minimize the human animal human biodiversity interface to prevent pandemics. And what I fear most is that we will not make the step, that our steps will remain focused on what they have been focused over the past year, which is simply mitigating spread and mitigating dealing with the consequences. And that we will not make the radical changes that we need to make to minimize the prevention of emergence of zoonotic diseases. And as long as we only stay on mitigating spread, and mitigating economic consequences and public health consequences, we will always be in the position of terrible consequences and ever-increasing number of zoonoses. And my last comment here is, we can easily have another zoonotic pandemic this year, taking place at the same time as COVID-19 is still continuing taking place.
Tobring, thank you, Vonda. David, this underscores how much we can't afford to have a purely rivalrous and confrontational relationship with China, because here is one issue among a number where we can only solve these problems working together. And yet, as you know better than most, the consensus that Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon helped create in the early 70s about engagement with China and a positive, cooperative, friendly relationship, that consensus seems to be gone as well. So how can we think about a partly competitive but also partly cooperative relationship with China that also keeps the threat of war as low as possible? This is a question that I can't imagine asking anybody but you for a sounder way to integrate these various competing concerns. Over to you, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. So my essay for the Blueprint series is called Getting the China Challenge Right, and it's written together with my Brookings colleague, Ryan Haas. And the punchline is that getting the U.S. policy toward China right is very complicated because China is simultaneously a challenger, a competitor, and a partner. It's convenient coming after Vonda because that's a good example of, you know, where we need to work in partnership. But let me start with the challenge part of this. I think it's pretty clear China is challenging our security relations in Asia. It's bullied some of our very close allies like South Korea and Australia. It's bullying other countries in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea. So it's definitely challenging our security arrangement. And it's also a challenge to universal human rights, I would argue, in the way it's dealing with Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Tibet. So no question China's a challenger. And I think the Biden administration has been very clear they're planning to repair our relations with allies and work more closely with allies on a range of issues, including dealing with China. What I would add here, I think very importantly, is if we're serious about working with partners, it means actually listening to them and changing our views or compromising if necessary. So if working with our allies means that we just expect everyone to fall in line, then I think that's probably not going to be a very effective strategy. But actually collaborating on these issues is quite important. Now, China is primarily a competitor with the U.S. in the economic realm, as I see it. And here, our response has been a little bit poorly coordinated over the last few years. But mainly what we're doing is trying to cut ourselves off from China in terms of trade and investment with various investment restrictions, export controls, 25% tariff on about half of what we import from China. And frankly, this has not worked out well. It has not been good for the U.S. economy, which was already doing poorly before the virus came. And it has not really changed China's behavior. It's quite striking that since Biden was elected, which is just a few months ago, all our major partners have signed new trade and investment agreements with China. So Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, ASEAN have a new trade deal. European Union has an investment deal. And these partners have made it clear that they think they can negotiate more balanced economic relations with China and address some of China's trade practices. And I'm pretty sure that these partners are not going to want to follow the U.S. down the road of decoupling from China or starting a new Cold War. So we really need to get back into the economic game. You know, we're being left out of these various trade and investment developments. Ideally, we should rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I think was relatively well designed to address some of China's abusive trade practices. That seems to be a big stretch politically. There are parts of that that we could take out, like collaboration on cross-border data, for example, regulation of cross-border data. We might pull that out of the TPP negotiation and just try to create a like-minded group of countries focusing on that. But just in general, we need to get back into the economic game. And that includes negotiating with China. President Biden has been clear he's not going to rush to remove these tariffs. And certainly the domestic issues are front and center for the time being. But I'm hoping that after most of this year has transpired, Biden team says they're going to review the trade deal and various sanctions that have been put on Chinese companies. I'm hoping after a year, perhaps slightly less, we get to a point where we can negotiate with China to reduce the tariffs, which have been hurting our economy, in return for various structural changes that we and other partners have been lobbying for. And then third, and I think most obviously, is that we need to partner with China on various global issues. You know, Vanda just discussed a really important one. I would also cite climate change. I just saw an opinion poll, Mike, that 56% of Americans think we should work directly with China on climate issues. And that's a very sensible reaction from the American public, because China is the overwhelmingly largest emitter of greenhouse gases. U.S. is number two. There's no way we're going to get good global cooperation on climate unless the U.S. and China are both pursuing pretty ambitious programs. And we don't necessarily have to be friends to have this kind of partnership, because it's really based on common interest and probably most successful in the context of multilateral organizations. But if we're not working with China, it's going to be difficult to address the global issues. Just last sentence is a third issue on the global scene that's important to my own heart, is the fact that a lot of developing countries are coming out of this global recession in very poor shape, including too much debt and need for debt rescheduling or forgiveness. That's the third global good where China and the U.S. have to work together, because China is the largest official creditor. The U.S. is the largest shareholder in the International Monetary Fund. If we don't work together, it's very hard to see how you're going to get a good resolution for many of the countries that are heavily indebted. So there's the challenge. You know, how do we call out China on human rights issues and bolster our security, create a more level playing field for the economic competition, and work together in multilateral fora on global public goods? That's probably the most important thing in the foreign policy realm that the U.S. administration has to deal with.
Thank you very much. And again, congratulations on an excellent paper. I can't imagine a more important time or a more important topic But I do want to ask you one final question, which is that I'm sure some other people, especially in my world, the national security world, will have listened to your presentation and wonder why you didn't talk more about security threats. And I wanted to give you a chance to elucidate a little bit. Implicitly, you seem to be suggesting that if we manage various hotspots carefully, we really should not have to think of the U.S.-China relationship as one that's prone to direct military combat. But I want to hear that from you, not just try to make an assumption based on my reading of your paper and listening to your presentation. So over to you. How seriously do you take the threat of war between the United States and China?
Right. So I will say, Mike, I did start with the security issues, that China is challenging our security alliances in Asia Pacific and around the world, and we need to respond to that. I think the threat of war is relatively small. The probability is relatively small. You know, some of the scenarios people have traced out in their minds, that China might take advantage of a period of weakness and chaos on the U.S. part, you know, say to grab Taiwan. You know, I think most of that is unrealistic. You know, the Chinese understand that any kind of really hot war with the United States is going to be a disaster. I'm pretty confident the U.S. would prevail, but it would be devastating for both economies and for the world system. So I think, given China's aspirations, you know, they're not likely to be looking for a hot war. But I worry very much that we might back into it by mistake. So there's a pretty good chance of miscalculation. You know, it could be over Taiwan, for example, or some of these other security issues. So, you know, it's definitely something to worry about. But I think the kind of deliberate pursuit of military hostilities, we're not going to see that.
Well, that's reassuring at quite a number of levels, although I'll just note for the record that I'm not even sure what it means to prevail in a war between the United States and China. And I'm a little less confident than you about how it would turn out. But we can save that for follow-on discussion. I'm still glad to hear you situate the military threat matrix, you know, the way you do, within the relationship, and with at least somewhat sober and calming words about our ability to reduce the risk of direct combat. But, you know, now going to you, Jim, David did talk a lot about alliances. He talked about how they have to adapt. And maybe that's the key towards deterrence of both China and Russia. You thought a lot about both those countries in your work over the years. And you and Lindsay wrote a very rich and thoughtful paper. So the floor is yours, please, to tell us how to think about alliances in this new era, when both latter Obama Pentagon officials and Trump officials have agreed that China and Russia pose the greatest national security threats. We got to figure out ways to address whatever menaces they do pose. Over to you.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And, you know, it's great to be with everyone. And it was great to write this paper with Lindsay Ford, such a great expert on the U.S. alliances in Asia. And, you know, one of the great things about being at Brookings is being able to write something with somebody as talented as Lindsay. And, you know, what we wanted to do in this paper, normally, of course, we think about NATO over here and U.S. alliances in Asia over here. And we really wanted to try to think about these more together, especially as NATO in the last year has started to talk more about what role it might play as it thinks about China. It's not, you know, don't expect NATO to be militarily engaged in the Asia-Pacific region, but certainly as a forum for discussion. And this challenging issue that David has raised about consensus, about What is the threat that China poses, how to respond to it, and for the U.S. really how to think across these regions, how to think about what it's doing with its NATO partners, what it's doing with its partners in Asia, and how to bring those together. You know, as we looked at in this paper at NATO and at the U.S. alliances in Asia, first thing you notice is that with NATO, you know, you have this alliance of 30. The goal has been, you know, it's not always achieved, but there is an aspiration for interoperability, for these countries to be able to work together, there's the military headquarters in Belgium. There's, you know, joint training and exercises, the NATO Defense College in Rome, all sorts of ways to create and foster interoperability. But in terms of the missions, what NATO's purpose is, I mean, this has been rather diffuse since the end of the Cold War and still remains a challenge because there are lots of different interests among these 30. You got the US and Canada in North America, and you've got a whole range of countries in Europe, whether we're talking about the UK or Spain and Portugal, or to the east, Poland and Estonia. And so you have that interoperability with a diffuse sense of mission, and then you turn to Asia and you don't have the interoperability, but you got a lot more focus on the particular challenge that China poses. So we wanted to really try to think about what that means, whether there are any lessons from the kinds of work that's been done within NATO as we look at Asia. There's not going to be an Asia NATO, but sort of creating more robustness. I do want to say on the consensus, because I think this is just critical in the challenge, especially within an alliance like NATO, that it's not over in the Pacific, and how do you forge a consensus in an alliance where there's differences of opinion on China, different levels of Chinese investment across Europe, different political opinion is different in most countries that we looked at. We have a nice chart that shows for most allies, the positive opinion toward China within most allies has declined precipitously in recent years. But there are exceptions. Poland and Italy, for example, where, public opinion is more favorable toward China than it was. The consensus, as David noted, the economic interests are great. He mentioned the trade agreements. And, this is such a difference from the Cold War. We were lucky during the Cold War. The Soviet Union took itself out of the global economy, which was particularly fortunate when it collapsed, because then it didn't have as big of an effect as it would have if it had been more integrated. China is integrated. China is, countries are dependent on that relationship with China, and that creates challenges for consensus. And also, countries aren't as interested in choosing sides. During the Cold War, if you were worried about the Soviet invasion of Western Europe, or you were worried about Soviet invasion for South Korea, when it was a war with North Korea. I mean, there was, and recognizing that China was involved in that, still, choosing sides was something that was easier to accomplish. Countries don't want to be in a position of choosing sides. And so that also makes it a challenge. You asked about new institutions. We didn't really see a need for new institutions, but really sort of making new connections across these entities. The one example we mentioned that's been out there ever since it was raised by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the D10, which we say could play a potentially important role for political consultations among democracies. That's a G7 plus South Korea, Australia, and India would potentially create a consultative body. But otherwise, it's largely about trying to create perhaps new connectivity. So, for example, one example that I think could be quite interesting. Last year, Secretary General Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, commissioned an outside experts group to produce a report, NATO 2030, released in November. Member states will, be pursuing some of the, presumably some of the things that were outlined in that report. So one of the things in that report was a Center for Democratic Resilience. What are we going to do as a group of democracies in NATO to help strengthen democracy, especially because we have countries within NATO that present a challenge on democracy, Poland, Hungary, Turkey. Certainly, the United States is hopefully emerging from a difficult time in dealing with democracy, but still has its challenges. And so that could be a very interesting new center within NATO, Center for Democratic Resilience. NATO also has global partnerships. So, and this includes countries in Asia that are U.S. allies. Well, you could bring those global partnerships together with something like a Center for Democratic Resilience within NATO, and you could really foster this kind of greater connectivity. I mentioned earlier the NATO Defense College in Rome, providing training and education for those who are going to serve or serving at NATO. And, you know, we looked in the paper at the potential for having some kind of similar entity in Asia that could help with creating and fostering greater linkages across officials in that region. Last thing I wanted to mention, because you and David were discussing it, and it's interesting to think about with respect to Europe and how it's beginning to talk about, NATO's beginning to talk about China, and that's a potential conflict over Taiwan. You know, Article 5 of NATO is applies when there's an attack in North America or Europe. So Article 5 doesn't apply in a conflict in Asia, like a conflict over Taiwan. But what if there's a U.S.-China conflict over Taiwan? You know, can Europe really just sit it out? The United States would at least, for example, want political support and might be seeking other measures from the Europeans without, you know, any idea that Europeans would be involved directly in any way. And that's the kind of thing that NATO countries should be talking about in advance. It's not a good thing if they haven't talked about it and a conflict erupts. So sort of doing that kind of scenario planning and how NATO countries might respond and the kind of political support that NATO partners might provide for the United States were such a conflict to arise is something that, for example, could also be a way of linking these two regions and something that should be done in advance rather than waiting until after a conflict erupts.
Jim, thank you very much for your remarks and for the paper. And that leads very naturally to Bruce Jones, who's thinking about democracies worldwide, which is a somewhat overlapping set of countries and agendas. But Bruce, I wanted to ask you to tell us about your argument and also explain the differences of a community of democracies or an effort orchestrated by democracies versus what Jim's just been talking about when you think first and foremost in terms of American allies. Obviously, there are some countries that are democracies and yet not American allies, like India and Indonesia, Bangladesh, Nigeria, you name it. There are a lot, actually. So that's part of the answer. But I'd rather hear you explain what you think that democracies can and should do at this juncture in history, working together, that they can't otherwise do, you know, in regional associations or alliances. Over to you, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for that. And an incredibly interesting to listen to all of the colleagues' perspectives. Look, I guess I end up in a slightly different place than everybody so far in the following sense. I share the view that the challenge from China, the greater challenge is not the military challenge. The greater challenge is the challenge to the dynamics of multilateral order as a whole. But that doesn't take me down a path of cooperation, okay? Let me just give you an example before I get into the arguments for my paper. We're discussing the need to cooperate with the Chinese on pandemics. We had an agreement with the Chinese, negotiated in 2005 at the World Health Assembly, new international health regulations that would have enabled far-reaching transparency and engagement on sort of questions of outbreaks, and a very robust monitoring mechanism of the WHO called GORN, the Global Outbreak and Alert Response Network. 2006, China runs a candidate for WHO, and between 2006 and 2017 systematically erodes WHO's capacity for infectious disease monitoring, right? We would be in a much better shape in response to the outbreak from coronavirus had that not occurred. And that occurred despite the fact that if you look at the question of Chinese influence at WHO versus U.S. or democracy influence at WHO, people point to, China's a big spender now and stuff. The democracies account for 44 times the spending at WHO than China. but we have never organized as a group of democracies to make sure that WHO is doing the serious work we need on infectious disease or whatever the sets of issues are. Okay, so that's one data point. Second, to Mike's broader question, Mike, we have seen in response to this kind of growing consensus on the China challenge, a response coming out of many centers in Washington, including Biden himself, saying the answer is greater consolidation of the democracies, right? So you can see from my first point that I'm sympathetic sort of in principle, but I think there are several problems in practice to organize as a unit of order around the democracies. There is serious new question about American standing as a democracy, which weighs into this. I don't think it's the most essential question, but it is there. Second, you have a number of countries who would be essential to any club of democracies or concert of democracies, kind of like India, Japan, who are still nervous about being seen to be pulled into a bloc which is explicitly anti-China in those terms. They're happy to deepen their cooperation with the United States in all sorts of ways, but they're nervous about being cast as part of an anti-China bloc. And I think that nervousness has increased in the last several years, even though they're concerns about China have also increased in the last several years. So they're looking for ways to do things that don't consolidate an anti-China club in a way that risks sort of breaking the order in their terms. And that's a serious challenge. Third, when you look at issues of economic questions, trade questions, et cetera, the democracies are not aligned. You know, in the last several rounds of WTO negotiations, it was Brazil and then India that blocked consensus, the WTO. It wasn't China. When you look at the global financial crisis, our biggest problem was with Germany. China was on board with what we wanted to do, and Germany was a problem, right? So in the economic space, the democracies don't align in the way that a kind of club of democracies might, you might think that they do. And then fourth, and non-trivially, of course, there are places where we are going to have to find some degree of cooperation with the Chinese, as others have said, infectious disease, financial stability, climate change, nuclear security, and the like. So what I argue for is that rather than organizing a club of democracies outside of the framework of the order, we do much more to organize effective cooperation among the democracies within the established institutions of the order. And to my surprise, when going into this, when I look into the patterns, it's done much less than you would think. You would think a kind of natural inclination when we show up at a body of the UN or we show up at the IMF would be to kind of organize among the democracies. It happens much less than you think. So for me, before we get into the business of creating a kind of a club of democracies that risks shattering key features of the order, we should test the proposition, at least, that organizing efforts of the democracies within the core institutions can improve our bargaining strength vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis Russia, vis-a-vis other actors, while leaving open the prospects for collaboration and cooperation with them where that's necessary, as it inevitably will be on some of these global issues. So it's an approach to mobilizing the democracies, but within the framework of what I call democratic multilateralism, within the framework of the order, rather than creating a block that necessarily puts China on the outside of the order.
Thank you. So two quick follow-ups. And then my plan is going to be to just come through the pecking order one more time and give each of you a chance to make a brief comment on where the conversation stands now, either further explaining your own argument or commenting on what you've heard from colleagues. And then I want to go to the audience questions, of which there are quite a few. So I want to get to that pretty quickly. But Bruce, first of all, if I could ask, is there any exception to that general point? Is there any specific new summit organization mechanism that you would advocate, even though it's not the center thrust of what you are recommending with Adam in the paper? And then secondly, you gave a pretty good example already of a concrete problem where working more effectively as a, you know, caucus of democracies could help us, and that was specifically on WHO. Is there another example that jumps out at you that's sort of a top-tier international economic or security concern where you really feel in your gut and in your head that if democracies did work better together, that they really could make a substantial improvement in international policy? Over to you.
Yeah. So thanks for that. And there is one place where I am advocating a new mechanism, although I'm careful about saying it in that way because I'm very deliberately trying to make it a mechanism which is adjacent to the existing structure of the border. So I'm glad you raised it. I wrote this with Adam Twodorsky, a very talented young research assistant at Brookings. I was delighted to have him as my partner on this. And we call for what we named as a Partners Council on International Security, okay, to which the participants would be all U.S. partners, not necessarily only allies. You know, Israel isn't an ally, but it is a partner. India isn't an ally, but it is a partner in a number of ways. All American partners, but versus a club of democracies designed essentially to challenge the council or to kind of supersede the UN Security Council, this would be designed to complement the UN Security Council. Okay, you know, in Washington, when we have debates about international order, I think this kind of default presumption is to look at NATO as the kind of pillar, the kind of ultimate pillar of international order. In most of the rest of the world, the UN Security Council is viewed as the ultimate pillar of international order, right? It's Article 2 of the Charter, and it's the core question of whether the major powers will agree to constrain the military dimension of foreign policy in their management of international affairs, which is embedded in the Charter. Russia and China have been assiduous in the last several years in increasing their influence in the council, working within the kind of broader arrangements of the UN to kind of mobilize support for their positions and to weaken Western positions within the council. What we're proposing here is that the United States create a parallel body, a Partners Council on International Security, in which it would bring its partners, India, Japan, Germany, Canada, Australia, et cetera, when they're not already present in the council as elected members, and involve them in consultations on the issues in front of the council's agenda, on U.S. positions going into the council. And I think it could strengthen America's hand in those negotiations in the council, because it leaves China and Russia, instead of just blocking Western positions, they would have to be blocking positions that had buy-in, and at least to some degree, from countries like India and Japan and others that have a very different sort of diplomatic texture in their relationships with the Russians. None of this stuff is a panacea. None of this stuff makes Chinese power go away. And I think that that's kind of an important point in the paper. We make the point that this is a modest proposal. It seems to me that there is some case for modesty in what we try to accomplish in these domains these days. And we can't pretend that Chinese power doesn't exist. It does. And so we have to find the right ways to compete with it, work with it, organize around it. This is a kind of modest proposal in that regard.
Thank you all very much. And now I'd like to give you each a turn to follow up with anything that's, you know, pressing on your mind, just very briefly. You can take a pass if you don't have anything, and then I'll get to audience questions. But let's just run through the same lineup, if we could, starting with you, Vonda.
Well, it was wonderful and fascinating to listen to the presentations. And I had the privilege of reading those extraordinary papers and the other papers that are part of the blueprint in foreign policy and at Brookings-wide. One of the issues that strike me really as a core challenge the core issue for U.S. foreign policy is how it is going to be making trade-offs among these different issues. When the issue of democracy or fostering security relationships in the Indo-Pacific come into conflict, what are going to be the basis of making the trade-off decisions? India itself has seen a significant deterioration of democratic and liberal practices internally. Is that something that, how are we going to integrate that into our efforts to partner up with India in dealing with the China issue? Or when the issue of cooperating on preventing deforestation comes into conflict with democratic practices or other issues, how are they going to be resolved? That, to me, is really the meat of policy, and we clearly don't want to replicate the fallacies of the Cold War of one issue overriding all the challenges or all the other issues, rather. And of course, we also want to mitigate and minimize the trade-off and sacrifice that needs to be made for each particular issue. The second comment, though, that I was struck as I was listening to the presentation, as I made my own presentation, and in fact, the thrust on new institutions and new architecture is that we have spoken about states and international bodies like the UN or the council that Bruce proposes, Bruce and Adam propose. And yet one of the big takeaways and consequences of COVID is the amplification of the power of non-state actors and their power vis-a-vis the state. Very broadly, states have been significantly weakened by COVID and will not easily be able to recreate the economic power and the law enforcement and security power they and legitimacy and authority they had prior to COVID. And broadly, non-state armed actors, criminals, militants, terrorist groups have been strengthened. That doesn't mean that every single actor has been weakened in every single way, and every single state and every single non-state armed actor has been strengthened in the same way or it's similar magnitudes. But this is the broader trend. And so we are now at a fascinating geopolitical moment where the geopolitical competition has been resurrected and dominates the many dimensions of the international system and our own thinking, yet the non-state armed actor agenda has not gone away and now overlaps significantly, including with issues such as climate change, such as pandemic prevention, because non-state armed actors, criminal groups, smugglers, militant groups play such key roles. So that's another point I would emphasize that clearly needs to be a significant element of our thinking in the United States and global thinking of how we are going to be dealing with the non-state armed actors. And perhaps the changes to our approaches in dealing with them are going to be more radical and fundamental than the creation of new institutions.
Thank you. David Dollar.
Mike, I'd like to take up your question about institutions. In the economic realm, I don't think we need to, recreate the economic system or create a whole new order. But I do think we're in need of pretty major overhaul at this point. The world's changed a lot. And to me, the main change is the rise of developing countries. And we need to increase the weight of developing countries and institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. And we also need to take on a whole set of new issues in the World Trade Organization, for example. So it's pretty major reset that's needed. I would just point out that when we set up those institutions at the end of World War II, they were open to both democracies and authoritarian countries. Jim made the nice point that we got lucky that the Soviet Union chose not to participate in the World Bank, IMF. They chose not to be in the WTO predecessor. There were lots of authoritarian countries in the economic order, but none of them was particularly important, with the arguable exception of Saudi Arabia. So now we face an interesting situation where, from a purely economic point of view, the logical thing would be to enhance the voting share of China, for example, get China into the Paris Club, which is the club of official creditors, but also India. India is becoming a pretty significant financier in the developing world. And you've got other major developing countries. So to me, that's the kind of institutional change we need, which will not be easy to negotiate, given all the different tensions we've talked about.
Thank you very much. Jim, over to you.
Yeah, I just briefly wanted to refer back to something David had said earlier about sort of U.S. attitudinal change that's needed, and that is listening more to others instead of thinking that we just go around telling everyone what to do, in this case, our allies. And we really need a change in the way we think about the U.S. relationship with Europe, the U.S. and NATO. One of the things that Lindsay and I talk about in our paper is just the need for really thinking about this more as a true partnership, as opposed to NATO as a vehicle for the U.S. to dominate European security. The U.S. is never going to rebalance its policy, foreign policy, toward Asia effectively, unless and until Europe can do more to deal with the issues in its own neighborhood, whether Eastern Europe or Middle East, North Africa. And so when Europe talks about strategic autonomy, we should be hoping that that's successful and that it actually is something concrete and meaningful instead of fearing it. And the only reason to fear European strategic autonomy is if we think we still have to run Europe. And, it's 2021, it's not 1991. 1991, you know, there was still concern about what it meant that Germany had unified, the fact that Europe couldn't deal with something like the Balkans. You know, 30 years later, if Europe is able to do more, the United States should be all for it.
And Bruce, over to you.
Two quick things. One is a very good point about trade-offs. You know, I've been sort of following the debate and talking to people inside about Myanmar over the last two or three days. And here you have a situation where we're faced with a coup led by the army against Aung San Suu Kyi and her party. If the organizing principle of American foreign policy should be support of democracies, we'll be working to condemn and reverse that. Slightly complicated fact, between the army and Aung San Suu Kyi is closer to the Chinese and the army is closer to us. So if the organizing principle is compete against China, we wouldn't be. And there are just going to be these contradictions. And so a kind of blanket, you know, we're pro-democracy or a blanket right in China just isn't going to work out in the real world. And navigating through some of these complexities is going to matter a great deal. I think that Jim's diagnostic and analysis of the kind of need for greater communication across the allies in Asia and Europe, it's a similar concern that animates my notion of the Partners Council of International Security. It's just a set of actors that aren't at the table when critical international security decisions are being made, and we need to develop a more flexible architecture to do that. Very last point. Ever since I've been in Washington, I hear this debate about whether it's geopolitical questions that matter or global issues that matter. And it seems to me absolutely bloody obvious both that they both matter and that you can't separate them. You can't separate the question of what it is to compete with China without looking at climate change, without looking at public health, without looking at financial stability. And you can't manage those issues without having a theory of how to deal with China's increased influence in those issue domains. So we've got to get past this sort of either or sense of either geopolitics or global and non-state issues. And Mike, you didn't talk to your paper, but you make this case for what you call 4+1, which is the four traditional security threats plus global public goods. And it seems to be increasingly focused on the need to think about global public goods as part of the core national security questions. It does have to be central to American thinking now.
Excellent, everybody. So now I'm going to give about 5 or 6 questions that I'm going to present from the audience and ask each of you to take notes and maybe answer 1 or 2 of them in the 14 minutes that we have left. And I will try to conclude by 3:15 because we appreciate our audience staying with us this long. And we know that in Zoom land, 75 minutes is a lot. So here are the 4 or 5 or 6 that please just choose 1 or 2 each. There are questions about democracy in regards to Turkey, Hungary, and Poland. And also relatedly, I suppose, Sudan and South Sudan, and whether we need to think differently about our foreign policies towards those countries. So that's one block of questions. There are questions about whether in getting tougher on China, we are going to not only complicate the climate and COVID agendas, but the North Korea agenda. A few people were interested in how they see the North Korea angle playing out. There was a question about the EU and its recent deal with China on investment and whether that's a bad idea, whether that's bad for the United States. And Jim Goldgeier, specifically to your point about strategic autonomy, is that the kind of thing we Americans have to learn to live with sometimes when Europeans make decisions we may not like or even agree with or even think are particularly wise? And yet, you know, how do we situate that within the broader set of relationships and priorities? And then finally, there's a question about the strength of democracy at home. You know, Richard Haass, our good buddy, said foreign policy begins at home. We've seen a weakening of this country, not only from COVID, but from partisan politics. And now we have questions about disinformation and fake news and the surveillance state and civil liberties. And I wondered, in addition to talking about, let's say, a democracy resilience initiative at NATO, if there are any specific suggestions from this group about American democracy and how we can strengthen it in 1 or 2 targeted ways. Anyway, that's a lot. But I know you're all good at picking 1 or 2. So Vonda, let's begin with you, please, and then just work down the list. Over to you.
Thanks. I'll pick the strength of democracy at home, which clearly has been massively eroded with its implications for abroad, but fundamentally implications for our own country. And strengthening the democracy really should be the core element of how we position our domestic policy and how we position our foreign policy. And strengthening the well-being, part of which is dealing with over 400 or close to 450,000 dead one of the things that I'm struck by, and to me it's a big sign of how much our democracy and our core sense of patriotism in the best sense of the world has been eroded, is that we are almost indifferent to the fact that 450,000 Americans have died in a year, that 100,000 Americans have died this past month. Those are death levels that years of our engagements and foreign wars brought or did not even bring about. And yet, we find it so hard to wear a mask. So many of us find it so hard to wear a mask to save someone else's life. That, to me, is a fundamental weakening of social fabric that has made us different and unique than a place like China. And so restoring that sense of fellowship, that associational capacity, is fundamental. One element of that is addressing armed groups in the United States, so-called self-styled militias and other armed groups, that are both a result of decades of internal policies, but also significantly a blowback from how we have engaged in our foreign policy. And that leads to the issue of, again, the intermestic, the international dimension, its blowback at home and vice versa. We have spent two decades fighting terrorism abroad, and yet the manner we chose to fight terrorism abroad is a key element of reinforcing and strengthening armed state actors to a massive way, a very dangerous way, as we have seen. So healing at home, restoring the social fabric, minimizing the blowback that we create abroad, is, in my view, a fundamental basis for both the core element of what policy should be about, peace, stability, well-being at home, but also a much better basis of our engagement abroad, both in terms of the symbolic power of the United States, but also in its other dimensions of power.
Fonda, thank you very, very much. David Dollar, over to you, my friend.
So I'll primarily address the question about the EU investment treaty. The US has been negotiating with China for a long time on various trade practices, investment practices, structural issues. In my view, we should be happy if any of our partners can negotiate progress in that area. So the European treaty opens up new sectors of the economy to 100% foreign investment. It has provisions on strengthening intellectual property rights protection and eliminating forced technology transfer. We still have to get some of the details, and enforcement is critical. But in general, when one of our partners negotiates something like that, frankly, it makes it easy for the U.S. to negotiate something similar. You know, once the Chinese have opened up a sector to European investment, there's absolutely no reason why the Chinese should close it to the U.S. investment, if we're negotiating some kind of economic agreement. So that just creates low-hanging fruit now if we want to pursue economic negotiations. The others may know more about the non-proliferation issue. I would just mention that Iran is also an issue here. And I was representing the U.S. Treasury in Beijing when we were negotiating the first Iran deal in the UN's framework. And China was actually a good citizen, cutting down its oil purchases, creating pressure on Iran. So if we're serious about, you know, this important global issue of nonproliferation, that's another area where U.S.-China cooperation is important. North Korea, though, is going to be tough because it's sitting right there on the Chinese border. I don't think the Chinese will play hardball with North Korea in the same way they did with Iran.
Thank you. And I'll make passing mention that our colleague Bob Einhorn has written a paper for this blueprint series on U.S.-Russia-China cooperation on the nonproliferation agenda, which has historically been an area where they do work together pretty well. You know, sort of underscoring your earlier point, David, that we don't have to always be friends to agree when we have common interests and collaborate. So thank you for teeing that up as well. I won't mention each and every paper in the series, but that was one directly relevant to what you just talked about. Jim Golgar.
Yeah, well, David already mentioned the investment agreement, but I would just say on that, I mean, we did have this interesting thing happen where Jake Sullivan, who at that point was coming in as Joe Biden's national security advisor, And the, you know, the Biden team wasn't allowed to engage directly with counterparts. So he tweeted out that he hoped that the Europeans would wait and consult with the Biden administration before proceeding with the signing. And, you know, that was ignored. So I think, you know, that aspect of consultation is important. This is an agreement that still has to be ratified. But I think, you know, when I say not to fear strategic autonomy and not to fear when, you know, Europeans may have different ideas about how to do things than the United States, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be consulting with one another as we go forward. I just mentioned the other question that was relevant was this issue of democracy. You know, countries like Hungary, Poland, Turkey in NATO, you know, and it's come up and people say, oh, well, why can't, you know, countries get kicked out of NATO? But, you know, there's a mechanism for countries coming in. Article 10 talks about countries that can contribute to alliance security and meet the principles of the alliance can be invited to join. There's no ejection clause. And because NATO operates by consensus, you know, a country like Hungary or Poland isn't going to, you know, support its removal from the alliance. So it does make it challenging. It, you know, certainly also we saw their role within the European Union also makes things challenging there. Easier to deal with those issues, relatively speaking, when the United States president is committed to democracy. So that, you know, is a difference post January 20th. And I think, you know, this is largely going to have to be dealt with in bilateral contexts. And certainly, you know, lots of thought's going to have to be given toward not rewarding countries that are not fully supportive of democracy and are carrying out policies at home that are creating, you know, I mean, in a case like Hungary, much greater authoritarianism within that country. The United States is going to have to really look for ways to try to address that within an institution, given the nature of an institution like NATO.
Thank you, Jim. And Bruce Jones, you get the last word today, my friend.
Thanks. Well, just building on Jim's point, you know, we've of course dealt with substantial non-democratic periods in NATO allies before, Greece, Turkey, and others. There's no absolute requirement that NATO members be democratic in those terms. But I think it does just go to this question of working harder with democracies across a whole set of range of issues to constrain the ability of authoritarian powers to erode key values and key institutions, but not being so purist about it that we weaken our own hand. If you were to organize yourself right now only among those democracies that meet the kind of highest potential standards, I mean, the share of world power that represents is a dwindling share. So we can deal with, you know, we don't have to have Hungary in everything we do. But are we really going to exclude India because it's not a pure democracy right now? I mean, that's, you know, then we're into some very narrow space. For all of the difficulties of contemporary Indian politics, just as there have been serious issues of our politics or Brazilian politics. So we're going to have to navigate that space. And is again where I come back to this notion of staying within the multilateral order, not breaking it, not trying to create new clubs where we're going to grapple with these impossible questions. Is Turkey in? Is it out? Is India in? Is it out? But in a more flexible way, working with countries where we have at least some degree of shared values and working to consolidate that voice and that sort of source of power within the international order, within the international system, but without creating that kind of sharp break that risks sort of rupturing the order and complicating things like DPRK. I would go a little farther than David. I actually think that, you know, in the last several rounds, China was pretty constructive on DPRK denuclearization. They see it as in their interests to not have a fully nuclearized North Korea, and they see it in their interest not to see an acute crisis in the Korean Peninsula. If we were to organize ourselves as a club of democracies or in a way that was kind of extremely assertive about sort of Chinese containment, I do think we would see them pulling back from a willingness to work with us on issues on the Korean Peninsula and elsewhere. So that's one of those ones, again, where a certain modesty in how we approach these questions, I think, would redound to our interests.
I'm going to put in a 30-second plug for modesty on North Korea myself. And even though it's not in my 4+1 paper, say that I would argue that the only realistic way we're going to get to a North Korean deal is to get rid of the idea that we can disarm them completely in one fell swoop. You know, that's been written about by a lot of Brookings scholars over the years, like Jonathan Pollack. Now our former colleague, Chung Pak, will have that portfolio at the State Department. I wish her and everybody very much the best on that front. I want to thank all of you for excellent papers and a great discussion today. Thank the audience, John Allen for the inspiration, Amy Liu for running the Blueprint series, and wish everyone the very best Groundhog's Day and beyond. And may it not be a year when we keep reliving COVID day in and day out the same way, even though today is February 2nd and we're thinking in groundhog terms. So over and out, best wishes from Brookings.